Hello, Deha. Welcome to the Flourishing Practitioners podcast, where we talk all things about space holding, caring for our clients, and succeeding in our businesses. We explore the wisdom from coaches, counselors, and healers. My name's Gabrielle Walker, and I'm so honored that you're here. Let's dive in.
So hello, everyone. Today, I am here with my friend Jade Rivera. She is an individual and couples therapist from Inner Expansion Therapy with a master's degree in counseling and psychotherapy, a bachelor of arts degree with a double major in psychology and addiction studies. She's also a clinical supervisor. Jade is a beautiful human being, and her aim is to help people learn about authentic connection through supporting their capacity and assisting the release of limiting beliefs and patterns. Jade and I had a really beautiful discussion, and at the end, we did record a little more, and unfortunately, my part came through very clearly, and Jade's didn't come through with the best audio, but I really wanted to share what Jade shared afterwards. Jade really wanted to emphasize that relationships can be a really beautiful space for consciousness building and finding our own personal growth. Often we come to therapy or we go to therapy as couples because we can't seem to communicate. We maybe feel like we're not being heard. We can be talking past each other. When we reach that space as a couple, it can be really easy to start questioning compatibility and wondering if you've chosen the right person, maybe looking and thinking that the other side of the fence is greener. So how we do things, how we speak, how we move about daily life, these can often be places of contention, but underneath is this deeper longing to feel seen, respected, and understood. So communication isn't just about what we say, it's about how we say it. But Jade doesn't believe that relationships are about finding someone that's perfectly compatible. A difference is often the very place that our love and our light and our ability to grow as people. And there can be a really big difference between a comment that carries blame and a request that carries care. So one invites defensiveness and the other invites choice. So when we learn as couples to soften our language and to be in service of the relationship, to make room for appreciation, gratitude, and genuine repair when we do have a dispute or when things do come up, we foster this culture of appreciation, and learning how to do good apologies and thank yous can radically shift the emotional climate of a relationship. This is something that I work on a lot with individual clients too, learning how to healthily make requests for our needs and our wants and our desires. We're not mind readers, and many of our misunderstandings are based on how we've been socialized and the assumptions we've made from our families of origins, the roles we've carried, and the scripts that we've learned to pay attention to. So when we really slow down and become curious about the person we've chosen to spend our life with, our relationship becomes more about consciousness, more about connection, and more about love. And we can really build places we may not have known were possible. But you want to hear Jade talk about this, so I will share her with you now.
We dance together. So we get to share that beautiful connection. And I asked you today because, well, I'm curious about your own journey, but our audience is always asking questions about couples and things to know. So yeah, see where we go with that.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The question I always start with is, what's sitting on your heart today?
Sitting on my heart, I think I'm trying to invite a bit more peace into my life at the moment. So that's where I am internally, is trying to maintain a bit more of a peaceful vibe, as you could say, and just trusting that whatever comes along, I'll deal with that and continue on and hopefully still be able to maintain a sense of peace. That's sort of where I've been at the last couple of days.
And, okay. I love that. What led you into becoming a counsellor?
So originally, I used to be a hairdresser, actually. And when I was about 26, I really wanted to do something else. I knew that I had capacity to do something different, and I wanted to learn something new. I was interested in nutrition at the time, but also psychology. And I tried to enroll in a course back then at university. And then the course, it wasn't actually available. So I was looking to do nutrition and psychology, but the university I went to weren't offering that course anymore. So I decided to just do nutrition. But I found the topics were, the sort of units I was doing were a bit dry. I had to do chemistry and, yes, really sciencey sort of units, which isn't necessarily my personality type. I like science, but I'm not a scientist. I ended up talking to the course coordinator at the university. She mentioned maybe dropping a couple of the chemistry units and picking up some addiction studies units and changing my degree to community nutrition. Long story short, I ended up picking up some addiction studies units and I really enjoyed learning about addiction. Then I looked into what's possible from here and I realized I could do psychology and addiction studies. So that's where I started. I did an undergrad, a bachelor degree with a double major in psychology and addiction. That kind of led on to, I got into the honors program for psychology, but it was very heavily kind of research focused and write a thesis. And I didn't particularly gel with that idea. I wasn't really as interested in doing that as actually practicing. And at the time I went and saw, I had some issues in my relationship back then. I went and saw a psychotherapist and she really helped me. I had, I think, only 4 or 5 sessions and she really helped me at the time. And I looked into, so what is a psychotherapist? And I looked into how to become one of those. And I realized if I wanted to, I could actually just enroll straight into a master's from my bachelor degree. So I did. And then I got into that program at ECU and I did a master's in psychotherapy and counseling. And that's sort of led me to this point. I mean, there's a few things in between that.
Do you want to say a few things? It doesn't have to be everything in your career path. But if there's anything that sticks out for you to say today that you've done in between?
So pretty much my bread and butter was addiction, drug and alcohol counselling. That's where I started out. I worked in a few different places in drug and alcohol organisations and integrated services. I ended up being a senior counsellor at one of those places of work and really enjoyed the supervision aspect and everything. But then I just felt like I had more skills. I'd just completed my master's and I'd studied family systems theory and psychodynamic psychotherapy. And I just felt like I wasn't really utilizing those skills in the place that I worked. And so then I ended up applying for a job at Relationships Australia, which, you know, they're quite family and couples driven, but they also see individuals. So I worked there for a few years and that sort of led me down the path of going into private practice. So drug and alcohol and then more couples family oriented work.
How did it feel to start your private practice?
I guess so. Originally I was just working from home and trying to get some clientele, but I hadn't actually signed up with any registration bodies. And it wasn't until I ended up signing up with the ACA, the Australian Counselling Association, that I guess it legitimised my business. I actually had a week off because I had COVID and it was during that some quarantine time. So I wasn't allowed to leave the house. So in that time, I got all of my documentation and paperwork together and ended up applying to the ACA and got registered. And then I set up a profile on Psychology Today and that sort of started to take off from there. And so I worked from home just from my lounge room, actually. And I also had some clients online that I would see. And then I got really busy after probably 6 months and I thought it would be better to rent a space. So then I rented an office, which is where I still am at now.
My intention when I started this podcast was to demystify a little bit of that behind the scenes thing or like stepping in and, you know, people always asking about different pathways into things. Is there any challenges you can think of along your journey that come to mind that you've had stepping in the therapy space?
I don't know. It's sort of a hard question. In a way, being a therapist is quite a different career path. And I don't know that many people would know what it's really like for us as therapists, because that part of us that notices things and is aware and has capacity doesn't really switch off. Sometimes I do notice it can feel a bit isolating in groups, particularly more so in groups with others, because maybe there's quite a lot of things going on that I'm intuitively picking up. And yeah, it can feel a little bit lonely at times, actually being a counsellor or therapist for me. But I'll say that then there's another part to this. I think being with the right people makes a big difference. So I'm fortunate to have some really beautiful people in my life that I can be myself with who are open and aware and intuitive and sensitive souls like me. And that makes me feel less alone in my experience.
That's great. Thank you. We've all got such different journeys or what inspired us, and it's usually pretty random, but it's good to hear it. How would you describe the difference between individual therapy and couples therapy?
Well, they're quite different because with individual therapy, it's really about building a therapeutic relationship with the client. And so I probably bring a bit more of myself into that dynamic with people. With couples, I may bring a little bit of myself, but I tend to be a little bit more outside of the system and observing, and I'm still building an alliance therapeutically with each of the individuals, but I'm also a bit more directive and a little bit more educational, because I find couples actually need skills and sometimes a bit of psychoeducation around what a healthy relationship is like, or not that I'm not an expert on that, but I kind of know what works and what doesn't, and we need to learn particular skills sometimes depending on what the presentation is, what the issue is for the couple. So I can provide a bit more information sometimes in the couple sessions than I would in an individual session. I'm sure there are other things that I may do differently. One thing that I'm quite aware of is maintaining neutrality and not taking either person's side or getting sucked into, maybe getting triangulated into the dynamic between them. So I've really got to be like Switzerland. So that requires sometimes me taking a bit of a step back personally and just holding space for two people, and really I'm focusing on their relationship between them, not my relationship with them, which is what I would be doing if I was working with an individual.
I was thinking it's such a huge deal for couples to come to counselling or to therapy. Yeah, what would you say to couples who are thinking about it?
I mean, it is a bit daunting. Look, I understand it can be a bit nerve-wracking, particularly if you haven't met the therapist before and it's the first time you've had couples therapy, or even the first time you've had any counselling. So seeing it as a service to your relationship, and I mean, I always just think it's worth giving it a shot. Like, even if you just try and have one session and see how you go, because it really is about finding the right therapist for you as well. So you might go for a couples therapy session and maybe one of you really dislike therapists. Well, if that's the case and you don't return and try that again, I think that should be okay. It's really about finding someone who is the right fit for you, because you've got to have a feeling of comfortability in the room and feel some kind of a safe connection with the therapist so that you can open up and talk to them. And usually if it's a good therapist or they've been practicing for a while, they know how to put you at ease. That's part of our job, is like holding space that is easy for people to be able to share what they feel without any judgment. So yeah, I think couples therapy is really great and can help a lot of people in their relationships, because we haven't really learned how to do relationship very well. And a lot of us haven't exactly had the greatest role models teaching us or showing us how to do healthy with each other. So, there's stuff to learn, and why not keep an open mind and give it a try and see how you go.
I like that description. That's really cool. What are some hints to therapists around maintaining that neutrality? Because I can imagine it would be really easy to get drawn into different dynamics that are happening, or judgments that you might have as well from your own experiences.
Well, I guess I'm still learning how to do that very well. I think what helps maintain neutrality is really being mindful of, how much each person is talking and making, and trying to make sure that it's fairly balanced. So if I may spend 10 minutes talking with one of the partners and listening and emphasizing and reflecting back with them, and I want to make sure that I give the other person, the other partner, sort of equal airtime so that it keeps balance. And also, I guess, keeping my own beliefs, values, judgment, my own stuff really has to be bracketed off, and I'm just there for them. I mean, sometimes that it can get a bit messy at times, or it can become harder if you really see a lot of yourself in one of the partners. So it's paying attention to my countertransference and not buying into that or using that therapeutically so that I can have a bit more understanding of how that is for the person or even for their partner.
Do you want to describe your understanding of countertransference? Because I find it's a tool we use a lot, but everyone's got a different way that we've understood how to use it as a tool.
So I suppose countertransference is my own reactions or my own feelings or sense that I might get in my body towards somebody. So let's say I'm working with an individual and it's a man, a male. Let's say he's 30s or something, and he's talking about upset towards, I don't know, his mother, for example. And maybe he's talking in a way that I find a little bit derogatory towards women. And so I might have some kind of a internal feeling of anger or frustration, or I might have some judgments. And I imagine that my own feeling towards him is how maybe his partner or his mother or other women, if he talks to them in the way he's doing, he's talking with me, they might be feeling that. So I can kind of use that and maybe ask questions around how that might be for other people. But it's, you know, that's my feeling. But I imagine there are also people in his life that feel that way when he's talking in the way that he's talking to me. So I can use it as a tool to help him to learn more about himself. Yeah, it's not personal for me. It's just that I'm having that sensation that probably other people have.
I think it's such a powerful tool for us to use, and I like all the descriptions. When you are doing some of those interventions with couples, what would be some common ones that come up?
Interventions-wise, if I was sitting with a couple, let's say a heterosexual couple, and the woman is speaking to me and her partner is there witnessing her speaking to me and me listening, and, you know, I try to make sure that if when one person's speaking, the other person isn't. So that may be set up as a ground rule from the get-go. And that also probably ties into a bit of the neutrality and keeping a balance and making sure it's all kind of even. And so if maybe the woman is talking to me and I'm listening, I'm maybe empathizing, reflecting back what I'm hearing, trying to take a position of understanding with whatever the things that she's discussing, the issue, the upset, the hurt, the anger, whatever that is. And by doing that, I'm relating and being with her that's different to what he might be used to. And maybe he might learn something from our interaction by witnessing it. So that goes both ways. I mean, it might be him talking to me and she's listening. It's almost like role modeling some communication skills of creating safety and empathy, because we sort of need to do that in our couple relationships. A lot of it, I find, is about helping couples to create more emotional safety. And to be able to be vulnerable and express themselves without the other person attacking them or getting defensive or, you know, blaming or criticizing. So learning how to hold a bit more of a gentle, kind space for each other and allowing ourselves to be influenced by each other in that way.
What are some other themes in couples therapy that come up regularly that could serve people in general?
I think that it's good to view healthy couple relationships as a space where we can grow and evolve as individuals and as a couple. So knowing that relationships are actually meant to help us to grow up and become more mature versions of ourselves, they also, I think they're one of the best vehicles for growth and self-awareness that we could utilize. That's something I might talk with people about, because I think sometimes in our society we've been conditioned to think that if we're in the right relationship, it should be really easy and no problems and, you know, no stress. Sometimes we're even influenced by Disney and Happily Ever After and The Prince Charming if you're a heterosexual woman and everything's going to be great once we find the person. Obviously, that's a bit of a fantasy. And so helping people to get into reality and actually, yeah, knowing that a relationship can help us to learn more about different parts of ourselves.
I hear that a lot too, even from the individual therapy session. It's like this perception that if our relationship was correct, it would be seamless and there would be no challenge. We'd just be on the same page. And that if you are actually fully evolving as a person in life, there's going to be conflict and challenge because you're choosing to evolve.
Yeah. And change is painful sometimes. And I think we are challenged to grow in relationship if we want to make that work in a fairly stable way where we're consciously relating to each other. The other thing I'm often helping clients or couples with is learning about conflict and repair, because there's a couples therapist I quite like, his book's Terence Real, and he talks about how every couple relationship goes through cycles of harmony, disharmony and repair. So harmony, disharmony, repair, and that's over the lifetime of a relationship. And I think it's good to keep that in mind because it really normalizes that we have conflict, we have disagreements, and that's okay. It's healthy. Gold can come out of those conflicts sometimes if we actually look at that and unpack that together and learn something from it, you know, learning about yourself and the other and helping to create a bit more safety. Because if we don't repair, often after conflict, I find a lot of couples that I work with, if I ask them after you've had a fight, what do you do? Well, how do you come back together again? Oh, we just get over it. We just get on with it. And so it's sort of like we sweep it under the carpet and we move on. But generally what that does is it creates a bit of a wedge between people. And every time you have another conflict and you get swept under the rug, the wedge grows a little bit more and it grows a little bit more. And before you know it, it's, you know, one of you's over on one island speaking one language and the other is on another island speaking another language. And it's always like we're both speaking foreign languages to each other. We can't quite meet in that space of being that togetherness anymore. And just normalize that, you know, we can work through things. We can learn how to, yeah, repair together.
And what are some good ways to repair? Because I hear that and I'm like, oh, sweeping under the rug could be one way of repairing, right? Mm-hmm. Like that could be a way where you're saying, oh, well, we're not in conflict anymore, so we've repaired. And I also just want to say this, because I get fine, this comes out of my mouth a lot. It's like, for me, one of the signals of a good relationship is how we repair, not how often we're fighting. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember who it is. It's something to do with Gottman. If you are repairing most of the time a good enough repair, mm-hmm. you can have a good relationship. It's not about the amount of time that you are in conflict or not. Mm-hmm. I think it's really nice for us to know.
Well, they also have a statistic. I think it's like if you're in a long-term relationship, you're going to agree to if it's working out, you know, you're pretty much agreeing to disagree 67% of the time. That's how different we are. And that's quite a lot. But I think that also, you know, that kind of leads into the different stages of relationships. So more broadly speaking, there's about three stages. You've got the romantic honeymoon phase, and then we move into the power struggle, which can last for years.
On and off.
And the power struggle part of our relationship is really about discovering each other's differences and learning how to accept those differences. So, you know, that first phase, initially we're sort of, oh, wow, like, do you like that? Oh, me too. Oh, you do that. So do I. like we're so similar. And then we start to notice our differences because inevitably every person is unique and different. We've got different history, different beliefs, different paths, different sometimes values. So, yeah, sometimes we are going to clash on things or, yeah, disagree. And it's a normal sort of stage of relationship. And we can really grow a lot from that, which moves us into the next phase, which is mature love. Doesn't quite have the same ring to it as romantic love. That's more about conscious relationship. So, you know, being a bit more self-aware, being a bit more reflective and getting to a space where you've learned quite a lot about each other. We continue to learn, but I think we also have to learn each other on our journey of our relationship.
Something I'm always really curious about when I do these is how it feels to, say, be a couple therapist or even individual therapist and going through your own things at the same time, like how you personally navigate that.
Sometimes it's really difficult. My partner and I have gone through a bit of a rough patch and had an argument, and particularly if we haven't repaired yet, because sometimes it can be a little while before both of us have regulated enough to come back together and talk. And so, yeah, if I have to go to work, I really have to put myself aside. But I also feel sort of humbled by it because I'm just another person walking on my journey, and the couples I see, I'm walking alongside them on theirs. And I don't get off scot-free because I'm a therapist. I don't have the perfect relationship. Nobody does. And so I guess I'm learning through that process to be easier on myself and join the human race. It's not easy, and someday that is challenging because it brings up a bit of an inner critic within myself, if I'm honest, and I think I should be better than this, I should know better. But as time moves on, and you know, I'm with my partner for it's been a few years now, things do get easier, and I get easier with myself, with my own flaws or inadequacies or the things that I'm not totally happy with within myself.
I think it's also inspiring in a way sometimes, even though that self-critic piece comes up, to know, oh, it keeps it moving, whereas if we were stagnant, it could be like a Groundhog Day or something like that. Like, oh, yeah, we're helping this person.
Sometimes I will even share that with couples. I won't share what I'm going through if it's something personal, but if I've had a moment being annoyed about something or had a little a fight or something, I might mention, I don't talk about the details of it, but I might mention that I was annoyed with my partner this morning too, and sometimes that happens. But just to kind of normalize that I'm just the same as you guys. If I can do it, so can you. You can learn these skills too. And I find people generally respond fairly well to that because I don't want to take a position of being an expert or being better than anyone. I want people to know that it's not easy. No one has it easy. We've all got suffering, or we've all got things that we've got to deal with that are not easy.
How did you find the difference between counselling couples when you were single compared to in a relationship?
I was less confident when I was single counselling couples. I think I was coming at maybe some of the couples therapy with a bit more of a psychoeducational approach and maybe a little bit more directive. I did well enough. I mean, I still saw couples and they came back, so that's a good sign. But I feel that I'm in the trenches a bit more these days because I'm in a long-term relationship and I get challenged sometimes. We've got to work through stuff sometimes. And yeah, I guess I'm learning the skills and practicing them too. And I really want to walk my talk. So it's fuel for me to continue growing and learning and getting better at relationship and relating and being with in a gentle way.
One of the questions when I said we were having this podcast was around what are some suggestions on how to fight well. I don't even know if it's fighting. When she was saying to me, she used the word fight, but I think what she was actually asking is how to like bring your point forward when you maybe have a differing point and don't have those skill sets to meet your partner in their conflict style.
I've probably been influenced quite a lot by the Gottmans. They've done a lot of, so John and Julie Gottman have done a lot of research, evidence-based research into couples therapy and couple relationships and what works and what doesn't. And so same with Esther Perel. She's got some really good ideas and Terence Real. All of those couples therapists are up there with some of my favourite. And often each of them talk about timeouts. So you may have a fight, you might have a heated discussion or an argument. And at some point when things are really escalating, we're not actually going to get anywhere with that. It just usually does damage to the relationship. So I always recommend taking space. That Gottman's call it a timeout. So does Esther Perel, I think. You might just say, whoever notices this is going nowhere, and you take space from each other to regulate your nervous system, to come back down to a more relatively calm space. Even if it means you've got to take a bit more time, that's okay. So taking the space and then coming back and then having the conversation around taking turns. Listening is a really important thing in couple relationships and not interrupting. So setting that up in the first place to know that, okay, this is what we're going to do. Once we come back together, I'm going to talk about what I recollect happened, what I made up about that, because usually I've got a story and you've got a story and they're probably quite different. And none of them are untrue, but they may be different. We sort of run our own reality. So my truth is maybe different to yours if we're in a relationship. So I talk about, I use a little bit of a framework sometimes with four questions. So this is what I recollect happened. This is what I made up about it. This is what I felt. And this is what would help me to feel better. You can do that and your partner can listen. They could even do another step, which if I was sitting with couples in my practice, I might even give them a bit of a like a cheat sheet to use. The partner may reflect back by using these four kind of statements. So the impact that I see was this one hearing from you. I'll take responsibility for X, Y, Z. And what I was protecting was, and what I'll do differently next time is. I mean, that's a bit formulaic, but it's really the main thing is being able to speak from your own experience while the other listens to you and hopefully can mirror back to you how you are, kind of validate your experience and provide a bit of empathy.
Pattern interrupt a little bit too sometimes. The only one I usually remember of it is like the story I'm telling myself, but then it interrupts me to go, oh, I'm actually telling myself a story.
Yes.
You know, like, oh, there is a story going on. It's not this full reality that's happening.
Because, I mean, usually when two people are arguing, they're arguing for their righteousness. Like, I had a supervisor once who used to say, would you rather be right or would you rather be in relationship?
Yeah, that's it. Would you rather be right or would you rather be in relationship?
We're often just arguing our point and making a case in point. This is why, this is what I think and feel. And so if we can get out of that and actually focus more on the space between us, which is our relationship, I think that can shift the way that we are with each other because you're more mindful of the energy I'm bringing into this dynamic. You know, if I'm coming at you and I'm attacking you, of course you're going to want to defend yourself. And then maybe you're going to attack back and then I'm defending myself. And that whole kind of attacking, defending way is not getting us anywhere good. So, you know, being able to step back from that and put the relationship front and center, let each other be influenced by each other, listen to each other and hear how that might be for the other and have some curiosity rather than criticism about it.
What I wanted to add is you mentioned about going away and coming back, but I think it's really helpful to set those sort of ground rules up when you're in a regulated space. So before the fight, so you already know, like with me and my partner now, I know that if he starts getting agitated and moves away from me, that's totally okay. Like he needs that time. I prefer he tells me, but if he doesn't have the brain space to tell me, that's already set up in the ground rules. So that's how we operate. And I'm not pursuing him or anything like that. So I just think that's a really important point to add. And it feels really weird sometimes. Like I'd certainly know we were going through a rocky patch a while ago and I wanted to set up some of these ground rules and it felt really weird when we were actually regulated to bring it up because I was like, we're in a good space right now. I don't want to talk about how we're going to fight when we're not. I just want to enjoy this moment. Yeah. But it's so helpful when you do have that opportunity to actually set them up and at least for me, more anxious leaning that when he's making more distance, that's nothing about me. That's just what we've set up as our ground rules.
Yes, that's a really good point because otherwise it can be weaponized. Someone's like, time out, like, I'm getting away from you. The other person may feel really abandoned or they might get really upset about that. So it's absolutely a good idea to kind of preface the next fight by having a conversation about how can we do things differently next time? Because that's what we're really learning every time, or maybe not every time, but a lot of the time when couples have arguments or they have disagreements and they both get upset and go into flight, freeze and fawn, you kind of, you know, when you come back to, if you do have that space and then you come back, it's really important to come back. That's probably one of the things I should have mentioned already is, you know, it's not about timeout and we don't then come back and both talk about our respective experiences. We make sure we come back, even if it's a day later. I think most of the therapists that I follow tend to say, you know, at least give it 20 minutes, half an hour, and then come back. Try not to leave it for more than 24 hours. However, sometimes it's not possible. You know, life happens and sometimes some people process it quicker than others. So just making sure that we come back to each other is us taking care of our relationship, talking about it beforehand. How are we going to do this next time? What's going to work better so that we don't get into this kind of hot water again and we both hurt each other again?
The other thing that we've set up as a rule is that we don't, when there's a conflict over a certain thing, we don't bring other things in. So it's only on that thing. And for me, it's really helped because I noticed in previous relationships, the other stuff would be really present. Like, here's my laundry list of things. And now it literally isn't there because that rule's there.
That's really good. Esther Perel talks about that, not bringing up the whole kitchen sink. It's a good sort of technique for not fueling the fight. Also, you know, because I guess when we do that, we sort of, we're still trying to argue for why we're right and the other is wrong or how our feels more important.
The other one, don't negotiate with the relationship. So in the past relationships, I've had this situation where I've been like, I don't even know if I want to be with you. I'm using the relationship as a bargaining tool. Where it's not that I want to break up, but it's just this habit. So yeah, don't negotiate with the relationship.
Yeah. I think that that's also really important because it creates unsafety if we do that. And we really want to be creating safety for each other and for ourselves. And, you know, if every time we have an argument, one of us threatens to leave, how are you ever going to find trust and stability and actually move into a more committed space together? It makes it very difficult because it just creates a lot more insecurity within us and between us.
There's a lot of talk about sort of narcissistic partners or these sorts of things online. What's your view on that?
I try not to buy into that narrative. I don't really like labels very much, although I can see why they sometimes do help people and help people to understand themselves. But I think we can get too stuck on this is who I am and I'm this label. I'm a narcissist or he's a narcissist. And it's just thrown around so much that I feel like it's misused.
Yeah, same. And I feel like it is more similar to what you were saying earlier, where it's misconceptions about the purpose of relationship or how you're using it as a connection. It's like this relationship or relating is supposed to fulfill my needs and that's the purpose of it. And when someone's saying that, they're basically saying my needs weren't met. Mm-hmm. But also then there's, what's the next layer beyond that?
Well, I also think people victimize themselves when they'll do that, because it's not a very empowered sort of stance to take. You know, your partner's the villain and you're the victim. It's sort of like, well, maybe we'll get out of that if that's your perception. Maybe that person is not the right person for you. Maybe you need to kind of empower yourself to take better care of you and choose more wisely who you spend your time with. Why would you want a narcissist in your life anyway? We can't change another person. And I think, you know, that's another thing that one of my supervisors used to say about changing the other person. Often we're trying to change our partners. If only you could be different, I could be happy. If you could just be this way or that way, then I'd be much happier. I understand that. But at the same time, I think we need to learn how to be more accepting of each other's differences, as I said before. And it's not about the other person making us happy. It's about making ourselves happy. And, you know, whether you're alone or whether you're in a relationship, your happiness is your responsibility, not somebody else's. Or even contentment's probably a better word than happiness. Happiness can be quite fleeting.
I totally relate to that. B once interrupted me and I was saying something. But I was reflecting something he wanted to change. I was like trying to support him, but then he was like, I'm really hurt by that. That's quite judgmental. And I was like, oh, even though I'm responding to something you've told me you want to change, mm-hmm. I'm still also jumping on board of that should change. Yeah. And I was like, oh, that's all good. Yeah. It made me think. I'm really glad he called me out on it. And then if someone is feeling that, I often have clients who want to leave. They know they want to leave, but they don't know if they're going to be okay.
Yeah.
And they don't know how to leave. Or even if they don't want to leave, there's a lot of overwhelm going on there. How would you see that?
I think we need more support from our people, which is also why it's so important to have our own individual lives and be a bit differentiated from each other, have our own stuff going on and our own people, our own support people that are maybe not our partner's support people, because we're supposed to lean on each other. We're interconnected, interdependent beings. So I would say, you know, getting the right support and also all your people depends on the situation. Sometimes people might be in a domestic violence situation, so that's a different kettle of fish altogether.
Yeah.
You need some like proper services to be kind of hooked up with in order to do that really well, that process of leaving. But if it's, you know, a kind of healthier relationship, then yeah, I think it's more about getting the right support for yourself.
Another piece I was curious about is when they do come to therapy, couples therapy, if they have different commitment to the therapy, how does that influence how you approach it?
That's a bit of a hard one, because I often find one partner is dragging the other along to couples therapy. So it's really important that I make a connection with both of those partners. Sometimes I will choose to do individual work with the individual partners, because I need to make that connection before with both of them to be able to work in that kind of neutral way with each of them. So if one of them really doesn't want to come along, I just suggest we do individual therapy with the person who does want to attend.
There can also be this thought that if someone's coming to couple therapy, the intention is for the couple to stay together.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, maybe that's not the direction. How does that feel to hold that space of a couple deciding on if they'll stay together?
I used to find that really difficult in the beginning when I first started seeing couples, which is probably about 6 years ago now. And I wasn't in a relationship either. So maybe that made a difference to my confidence levels. Or, you know, maybe because I was a beginner couples therapist. Yeah, I didn't feel comfortable. I felt like my job was to keep the couple together at all costs, like make salvage this relationship, focus on the relationship, how important it is. Now I don't have that process and I don't think the same. I think that if people want to sort of, yeah, consciously uncouple, then, you know, maybe it's my role is more about holding a space for that and helping each of them learn or talk through what they're taking from this relationship and being grateful that they had the relationship and what they learned from that. I don't think we should force anyone to stay together if that's not working for them. And sometimes people do uncouple or stop their relationship. And then they may get back together later because actually there's more there. But at the time, sometimes we need to actually take that break in that space to discover that, oh, no, this person actually does mean a lot to me, and I would like to be with them, and maybe we just need a bit of space to kind of reflect on ourselves and what we want.
How do you see the role of couples in society in general, that piece of privileging a couple? You know, there's these narratives or scripts from society about, oh yeah, it is better to be in a couple, and it is set up that way. I certainly remember when I was single, little things like at Christmas, I would be the one that had to sleep on the couch, whereas everyone else got rooms. Yes. Because I was single. Then once you're not, oh yeah, you get a room. Mm. The tiny things, that there's those little messages everywhere. But then also, if you think back to my parents, like not many people at that time were getting divorced, or they were certainly those first rounds of getting divorced. Mm. And now it's like quite common.
Well, I think that if you're in a couple and live together, you financially benefit more than single people living alone. And the society that we live in is kind of set up more for couples and families than it is for singles and individuals, unfortunately. And there's a bit of disparity there. It's also interesting, I think it was Esther Perel talked about there being a lot more affairs back in those days of kind of the 60s, 70s, because people didn't want to divorce. And nowadays we have higher divorce rate and probably less affairs, I suppose. I don't actually know the statistics on that, but I just thought that was interesting. It's just a different society, or it's like cultural and generational change. So it's interesting how there's trends that also change with the generation. But yeah, what's about the couples? I think because we do live in a society that probably being in a relationship is something that most people want or seem to want, I think it also influences people to stay in relationships that aren't serving them for longer than necessary, because I found a lot of people are afraid to be alone and actually enjoy yourself and create a life for yourself. You're much more equipped to have a relationship with someone else, because we're always navigating that togetherness and separateness when we're in a couple. And if it's difficult for you to have the separateness and be alone, it creates more codependent sort of patterns, and it can create a lot more trouble actually for the partners, depending on attachment and things. But the way that we interact can become more difficult if we haven't learned how to regulate ourselves, or if we're not learning how to be alone and be okay with our own company and have our own lives going on. Because I think the healthiest relationships are ones where there's two people in the relationship, but they've both also got their own lives going on. They're still individuals, and they still have their own hobbies, maybe different friends, activities they do, their own kind of work, whatever. If you've got two people that have their own lives, they can kind of come back together and enjoy each other, but also have their space that they go back to with their friends and hobbies and activities and their work and their life.
That's beautiful. I'm curious, what's your attachment style?
I'm probably leaning towards more the anxiously attached. I've probably got a bit more secure attachment these days, but yeah, I'd say historically speaking, I'd be anxiously attached.
I always think now I'm more of an anxiously attached secure. I've become more secure as I've got to know myself more. But I was always obsessed with relationship things because of that anxious attachment. And I would say it was this, like this, if I solve relationships, the world will be perfect. And then it's like, you get into a relationship, you're like, oh no, the world's not perfect. Still love this person. But yeah, the world's not perfect.
Also, the attachments can change depending on the partner that you're with, because people that have a tendency to have a bit more of an anxious attachment style tend to gravitate towards the avoidant attachment style. And I know personally, I've also been with partners who've had an anxious attachment in the past, and it's made me a bit more avoidant.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how that dynamic plays out. And it's not, I think it's fairly fluid. I don't think it's big. And it does change over time and depending on the relationship we're in at the time.
Does attachment resonate with people, or have you thought of it in another way?
I think attachment theory is becoming a bit more widely understood by just even laymen. I have clients who will come to me and they'll tell me which attachment style they have. So it's in our language a bit more than it probably used to be. And I mean, some people don't have any idea about it. And in which case, for individuals coming to council to talk about relationship, I'd probably be more likely to introduce the idea of attachment styles to them. With couples, coming for couples counselling, I try not to be too diagnostic, but I will use what I know.
The patterns.
Yeah. And if I can see that, sometimes it's plain as day, then I will work in such a way where perhaps I'm going to try to get the more avoidant partner to speak more about what they're feeling or to get more in touch with their body and, notice what sensations and feelings are coming up. Maybe with the more anxiously attached partner, it would be about encouraging them to do a bit more of their own thing and maybe relying less on their partner, differentiating more, having less emotional reliance upon their partner to make them feel needed.
When I first asked you to do this podcast, something you said was that you have a different view on relationship counselling, and that's out of why it was like nerve-wracking to do this. What comes to mind when I say that?
I think I said that because I don't know that I'm practicing exactly how I was sort of taught by the book when I went to university. I'm not. I brought a bit of my own style or flavour into the counselling, and maybe I sometimes do share a little bit more. I might share a little bit about something that I might have gone through if it's relative and if it helps the clients. I wasn't taught to do that, to self-disclose. I find it actually builds a bit more of a lie, particularly if I'm working with people around the same age as me, because I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm in this too. And it's not easy sometimes. And what I might do in that situation is I may even sort of refer back to myself and say, if I've had a similar experience, you know, what worked for me was it's up to the person what they take. So I think, yeah, when you asked me about coming to do the podcast, yeah, I don't know, maybe it's just a little bit of my own insecurities as a therapist that make me think, oh, you know, am I going to be good enough to share?
Yeah, I totally get that. I think we all have that. I use quite a bit of self-disclosure as well, selective self-disclosure. And I've had the feedback from clients that they really value it, like anchoring it into a real story rather than random advice. Then I know when I go to see a therapist, I prefer that as well. I don't need their whole life, but something human. And if I'm just talking, I've had also therapists where I don't feel as connected to them, and it's like they're almost like a robot, and I'm like, this doesn't work for me. So maybe I'd use my own preferences as well sometimes. It won't work for some clients, but it's how it feels more natural to me as well. Something I found just randomly generally funny is I think therapists in general, we can be quite hard on ourselves, or imposter syndrome, like our inner critic about things. I notice that we can get really like, what's that? Do you have that?
I do sometimes, probably less so these days than in earlier days of counseling people. But still, it comes up. It's part of life, maybe. And I think it comes from wanting to do a good job and wanting to help people. And if I feel like maybe I've been not quite on the ball, or if I've had a session with people, it could be an individual or a couple, that I'm not sure how well it went, it may play on my mind later. And I'm thinking about how I could do that differently next time, or where I should be focusing my attention and helping the client, what I should be helping them to reflect on and explore. It just means you really care, you give a shit. That's why you think about it.
I love that. Something which just came to mind around some people, relationship can be the primary area where they look to grow when you're in that phase of wanting to find relationship or connection. Yeah, when I was single, I would like absorb so much relationship information. I was always looking for this hack, but I think I was actually coming from more of a manipulative space of wanting to have a relationship so I would feel better, rather than how we're talking now, which is more like growth and then it's a natural occurrence. So how do people who are single and maybe looking for a relationship find trust and not having to improve that next thing? Because I think every other area in our life sort of works in the way of like, okay, business, you put more energy in, more comes out. Study, you study more, you get better grades. Relationships not like that. It's so different.
I think it always comes back to our relationship with ourselves. Like, we can want to have a relationship, we can read all the relationship books, we can do all the relationship courses, but in that way of functioning, there's a need, there's almost like a desperation or something. It's like, I'm trying to get something. And sometimes when we're really trying to get something, we actually push that something away. I'm not saying don't learn about relationships, don't read the books, don't do the courses, but making sure you've got other stuff going on in your life and you're not just solely focusing on that, so that you get the outcome of a relationship.
It's such shitty advice at the time, isn't it? Yeah. I remember people used to say that and I was like, oh, you've done been counseling people all day or whatever. And then you're like, oh, I'm going to go try and find a hobby. Yeah. It's like, what the fuck? I used to hate that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree with you.
We don't want to hear it. But one of my favorite people in the world is my mentor. You know, she talks about really having to come to terms with who we are in our life. And so I think that that touches on that point. How do I be the fullest expression of me in this moment right now in my life? And that's more focused on you. That's not focused on anyone else. So it's creating yourself, which is what you are in control of. We're not really in control of much, but that is something that we're somewhat in control of, is who am I being? Who do I want to be? What does she do or he do or they do with their time?
As we wind towards a close, is there anything else you need to share that's sitting there that you haven't been able to speak on? Or
there is one thing that I thought about earlier, which I didn't mention, and it's just related to some of the work of Terence Real, who talks about the two different parts of us that are often activated in couple relationships. So he talks about the adaptive child part of us. I'm actually going to tell you how he describes the adaptive child. So he says that it's a kid in grown-up's clothing, and usually they're quite black and white. If we're having an argument with our partner or we're upset about something, we might not be arguing or disagreeing, but you're just in a bit of a mood or that something has happened. Maybe there has been an argument. Often we can be quite stuck in our kind of wounded child part of ourselves. Terence Real talks about that part of us being black and white, perfectionistic, relentless, rigid, harsh, very certain, and usually our body feels quite tight. He talks about us moving into more of the wise adult, which is the mature human being part of us, which, you know, is nuanced. It's realistic, forgiving, more flexible, warmer, more yielding, more relaxed, and more humble. I found remembering that even for myself in my relationship really helpful, because I can then sort of delineate which part am I in. I can really tell when I'm in my child part, because I'll be probably upset. I'll be ruminating. I will feel tightness in my body. I probably have a little bit of anxiety in my background. And what I want to be doing is finding a way to shift into that wise adult, mature part of myself that can kind of take a step back and observe what's happening and not necessarily buy into the storyline that my child is telling me about what an injustice that is. And whatever that is at the time, it's just a story.
I'm not getting this. I'm not getting this. You don't give a shit.
You don't understand me.
Yeah.
So I find that is pretty helpful because, yeah, potentially relationships are vehicles to help us grow and mature into more of who we are and more of what we're capable of, more of our capacity.
Is there anything else on your heart to share at all?
Well, there's another therapist I quite like called Havel Hendricks, and he talks about how we often, the partner that we end up being with is someone who has the positive qualities of both of our parents combined, but also has kind of the emotional wounds of the parents. I really love the idea of us attracting each other, maybe being with the partner that we find and learning and growing and healing with each other, because we're supposed to, because the right relationship will help us to look at ourselves and maybe work through some of our old wounds, because I think the right person will love you at your worst and at your best. And hopefully that gives you a space that feels safe enough to explore and maybe have arguments in there sometime, but then learn how to repair and kind of find a bit more love and connection and care for yourself and each other in that process. Right. I think we are supposed to heal in the right relationship, because all of our wounding happens in relationship. It has to be healed in relationship. Yeah. I found doing some of Esther Perel's courses was really helpful. And one of the things she talks about with, you know, when a couple has conflict, we're usually arguing. It's not about how the dishwasher is stacked or who did the vacuuming last, or, you know, whatever the little shitty thing is that the argument starts with is not at all what it's about. And she says, Esther Perel says there's three broad reasons why people fight. And it's usually, firstly, the person that might be about respect. So power, dignity, autonomy. It's about feeling like you're being taken seriously and treated as an equal. Another thing she talks about is connection, and also love, care, and emotional safety, and how this is about feeling emotionally close and supported and being able to rely on each other. And the last thing she talks about, what we fight for, is recognition and validation. So being seen and chosen and desired by our partners. And that's really about feeling acknowledged and valued and truly seen, and not just loved, but recognized for who we are. So, you know, I think if we really dig deeper and look underneath of why we're maybe fighting, there's something really important there to know about yourself. And usually there's something really important to learn about your partner too. So the surface isn't, it's not what it actually appears to be. There's a lot more to it. So even knowing that and learning and developing more awareness around why you're fighting, what are you fighting for, could help you to learn about yourself and the other and grow and change and evolve from that.
Thank you, Jade. Appreciate you so much. That was really beautiful.